Well, hello, everybody. Someone over on Patreon asked, Drac, how do you design a naval steam propulsion system? And a lot of people seem to agree with them because, well, that was one of the highest voted options on the monthly Patreon poll. So today we're going to go over some of the considerations that you might want to keep in mind when you are designing your naval propulsion system. So, first one, are you going to use steam at all? Now, of course, this does depend on when you are considering building or designing your naval steam propulsion system, because, of course, if you are trying to design such a system in 1800, I have news for you, you are going to fail. It sails all the way. However, if you are trying to do this in, let's say, 1930, there are a few options on the table. For example, you could use diesel, which doesn't involve creating steam. And this brings us to our first little conundrum, at least for the time period the channel covers. Diesel engines, when they exist, are more efficient. They will get you further for a given amount of fuel, but their energy density is less, i.e. if you have a certain square footage or volume that you're going to fill with some form of engine and you use a diesel system, the overall power output of that is going to be less than the equivalent in a steam propulsion system. So at that point, if you want speed, diesel's probably not the best bet, but if you really like range, probably a good idea. However, you also have to factor in that fuel for steam propulsion systems by the early 20th century is available in all sorts of wonderful places. Diesel fuel in any great amount, not so much. So you might have to start thinking about taking on board some kind of fuel purification system, like the Deutschland class had. But of course, that adds to weight, takes up space. And if you do want diesel and speed, you're going to have to devote quite a large proportion of your internal volume to propulsion systems. That may obviously then compromise, if you're designing a warship, which we're assuming that you are, the amount of armor, the amount of weaponry, the amount of supplies, the amount of crew, etc., that you might be able to fit on board. But if your objective is purely to go a very long distance on a minimal amount of fuel, then sure, go with diesel. You could, of course, also go with a combined power plant. So you could go with perhaps diesel on a central shaft, if you're the Germans and you have three shafts, or you could go with diesel on two inner shafts, if you're somewhat more sensible and have a four-shaft system on your capital ships, with steam on the outboard shaft. So this would be theoretically able to give you the long-distance cruising capability of diesel and the high-speed steaming capability of steam at the expense of a somewhat larger machinery plant than you might otherwise want. And of course, you have to carry two kinds of fuel and have two separate kinds of engineer trained on two separate kinds of propulsion systems, which could be problematic. But ultimately, it's all down to what you can afford and what you want as your final objective. Now, assuming that you have chosen a pure steam propulsion system, or you're thinking about what you're going to do for a partial steam propulsion system, you then have to think about what kind of fuel are we going to use. Again, if you're doing anything up to about the first decade of the 20th century, you are pretty much restricted to coal. So good luck shoveling. However, once you get into the 20th century, you start to see the rise of mixed boilers. So you can have primarily coal, but spraying oil on there to help with the burning, increasing the power output. And as you get into the 1910s and thereafter, you start to have more and more access to oil firing for your steam plant. Now, there are, believe it or not, some benefits to each system. Yes, pretty much everybody in various navies switched over to oil, but as the Japanese would find out in the late 30s and early 40s, oil does have one drawback. Coal, even if it's not particularly good coal, can usually be found in some way, shape, or form in most countries. Oil, not so much. So that means you are going to be dependent on some kind of foreign overseas oil supply, unless you happen to be one of those very lucky countries that has naturally occurring oil fields, or your country is just so large that you will inevitably have some naturally occurring oil fields in it at some point. Or potentially you've gone out and nicked a bunch of other people's countries and they happen to have oil, but in those cases, you still have to get that oil back to your home country. which, well, other nations might have something to say about. But outside of the possibility of not actually having any fuel, oil is otherwise fantastic. It gives you more energy per unit of mass than coal does. It's much easier to refuel, much cleaner to refuel, which is a great boon to your crew. You don't need as many crew because you don't need stokers anymore. Although the rank is retained, the general idea of needing several hundred men to shovel large amounts of fuel into furnaces dies a death with the coal propulsion. And if you run out of oil in one of your fuel tanks, you just go, okay, well, I guess we're drawing oil from another fuel tank. Whereas if you run out of coal in one of your bunkers, it's a bit of a walk to another bunker. But of course, you have to trade that off against, well, first, the technological capabilities of your nation. Second, the potential security hazards of relying on oil from overseas, if that is how you're going to get your oil, which most people are going to. And finally, depending on the ship that you are designing, given that oil is a little bit more expensive than coal, do you need all these performance boosts? If you're designing a particularly slow vessel that's not going to be expected to run at very high speeds for extremely long periods of time, then coal might be easier to access and cheaper. It's very rare that you would make such a decision, but if you happen to have local coal deposits and no local oil deposits or no easy access to oil from overseas, coal might be a solution for things like small escort ships. But assuming that you've got past all of that, and let's assume you've gone with the most common choice for the 20s, 30s, and 40s, which would be an oil-fired steam system, you now get to choose what kind of engines are your lovely steam boilers going to power. Of course, in the mid to late 19th century, you have a choice of trunk engines, compound engines, and double compound engines, basically as they are invented. But again, we're going to be setting our question, apart from referencing what some of the earlier technologies were, mostly in the late 1910s and onwards, because that's where you have the widest variety of choice. Now, you could go old school and have vertical triple expansion engines. They are relatively easy to manufacture. They aren't particularly brilliant at running at exceptionally high speeds for very long, although the advent of forced lubrication does solve that issue somewhat. They are very big and they are prone to generating a lot of vibration. But as I said, they're cheap and easy to build. So if you have a throttle of some kind, whether it's some kind of industrial bottleneck or a lack of funding to build some of the more complicated engine systems, it might be worth a thought, especially if, again, you're building something that isn't expected to go particularly fast, like a convoy escort. Then you have the next step up from that, turbines. Turbines, somewhat easy to build, a little bit more difficult to build than a vertical triple expansion engine, but can still be mass manufactured. They're a lot more compact than vertical triple expansion engines. They cause nowhere near the amount of oil and steam and vibration spraying around everywhere that you get with vertical triple expansion engines. But they only tend to work particularly well at one speed setting, and as pure turbines, that speed setting is way, 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 way faster than you really want to go, at least in terms of RPM on your screws. So both efficient and inefficient at the same time. And that, of course, brings us to a splitted engine choices that occurred in the late 1910s and early 1920s, particularly in the US Navy, but occasionally elsewhere, geared turbines or turbo-electric drive. So with geared turbines, you obviate the problem that your turbine is going at several thousand RPM by sticking a monstrous set of gearing in to reduce your shaft rotation speed to tens or hundreds of RPM, which is something more in line for a propeller that doesn't want to die immediately of horrible, horrible cavitation. This, of course, massively increases the efficiency and therefore range you can get out of a turbine propulsion plant, but ultimately the turbine still has a fixed speed which it is best at, and therefore there are still going to be speeds which you are less efficient at. Now, you can solve that by having a variety of different turbines, which we will mention in the next segment, but even if you have a high-speed and a low-speed turbine, there are still going to be speeds in between where you're not quite as efficient as you could be. Enter the turbo-electric drive. The turbo-electric drive is paradoxically more and less efficient than a geared turbine because it introduces another step. So you still have your boilers, you still have your turbines, But then instead of the energy going into a gearing system and then down to the propeller shafts, the rotational energy of the turbines is turned into electrical energy by means of generators. This electrical energy is then conducted to big motors, and the motors turn. Now, of course, dialing the amount of electricity that the motors receive is pretty easy and fast. You can put as much energy into reverse as you do into going ahead. And, of course, you have the multiple redundancy of, oh, well, that motor's burned out. I guess we'll just divert the electrical power to this other motor instead. A little bit more difficult to do with pure mechanical linkages. But there are two drawbacks. Firstly, as I said, it's both more and less efficient. This is because you've introduced another step in the energy transfer process. And every time energy changes its state or is transferred from one place to another, it loses a little bit of its energy because there's no such thing as a perfect conductor, at least in the early 20th century. Who knows what they'll come up with in the future? And so for a given amount of energy put in at the boiler, the amount of energy that reaches the propeller shaft in a turboelectric drive is going to be slightly less at its best efficiency than the best efficiency of a geared turbine. But the geared turbine only runs at that efficient state at one speed setting, as we've already discussed. Whereas with the turboelectric drive, because you're not changing the speed of the turbine, you're just changing the amount of electricity going into the motors, your turbines, as part of your turboelectric drive system, can run all the time at their optimal efficiency rating, which means that if you want to use somewhat arbitrary scales, if a geared turbine can run at 9 out of 10 efficiency at its optimal speed, but otherwise is running at 3, 4, 5 out of 10, and your turboelectric drive is permanently running at 8 out of 10, then unless your ship is spending a huge amount of time at that 9 out of 10 setting on the turbine, the turboelectric drive overall will probably save you a bit of money because it will save you a lot of fuel and potentially allow you to go a bit further. But the other downside is that, again, because you've introduced another step, you've introduced these big generators and electric motors, the whole system takes up more volume and is heavier. Now, if you're building a ship relatively unrestricted by treaty, then that probably doesn't matter too much because the weight and volume difference between a turboelectric drive and the equivalent in geared turbines can most likely be made up by just making your hull slightly larger than it otherwise would be. But when you are operating under treaty restrictions, like you should be doing if you're in the 1920s or 30s, or perhaps there's a budgetary restriction that wants you to limit the size of your hull for whatever reason, now turboelectric drives could cause a problem because every additional square foot and every additional kilo or pound that this system is taking is stuff that you can't put into guns and armor. So you do have to make a fairly big decision there. But let's assume that you've done what most people do at the time and you've gone with geared turbines. Now we're looping back to what we mentioned a little bit earlier about having multiple types of turbine, because you can have high pressure turbines, which use the steam coming directly from your boilers. But then what happens to that steam? That steam normally would just go away to the condensers, but there's still a fair amount of energy in it. So most systems, by the time turbines really get established, will have a high pressure turbine and a low pressure turbine. And as the name suggests, the low pressure turbine will use the exhaust steam from the high pressure turbine and get a little bit more energy out of it. As a result, the low pressure turbine blades on their rotors and the rotors themselves have to be quite a bit bigger. Okay, that's not a very difficult choice, but then there's potentially a couple of extra turbines you might stick into the system. Now, why would you be sticking even more turbines in there, you might ask? Well, what are you going to do about going in reverse? Now, you see, you could do a number of things with a steam propulsion system if you want to go in reverse. You could, at least in theory, bring your turbine to a complete stop and start feeding steam in the opposite way round to the way it was going before, which in theory should make the turbine blades spin the other way, and thus you go in reverse. This saves you on having to put anything else in if you want to have a reversing capability, but it does require you at very minimum to wind your turbines down to zero before you do anything. And well, ultimately that turbine was designed to go the other way, so there could be issues there, but it's possible. Alternatively, you could just put in a straight-up reversing turbine, which will usually just be the same as one of your other turbines, maybe a bit smaller, because you might not need as much power, and it's just facing the other way. So you feed steam in the normal way, it spins around, but because it's facing the other way, the rotation is the opposite direction, and then you link that in to your propeller shaft. If you are using a geared turbine system, this is an excellent time to deploy your clutch, as found on HMS Belfast, because obviously you then declutch the gears that are coming from your forward propulsion turbines, and then you can engage the reversing turbine. As you'll note with this label, don't do that when you're running at high speed, because grinding gears on a geared turbine set is a very, very expensive way of coming to a complete and utter stop. So there you have a trade-off of weight, additional weight and volume versus power and efficiency. But there's another kind of turbine you might want to install, a cruising turbine, because of course you might not want the full power output of your main turbine set, but as we mentioned, running a turbine at below its optimal spin settings does tend to end up with very inefficient usage of your fuel. So you could just have a smaller cruise turbine. It will still run at a relatively high speed, but it's not going to be generating anywhere near as much power because it's smaller, and therefore it's putting less energy into the gearing system, and therefore the output at the other end is a much lower RPM. Now, again, you have a trade-off. It's more weight, it's more space, but in terms of propulsive efficiency, it may be more efficient. So do you take it up, or do you just run your bigger turbines at a lower speed and accept that inefficiency? A lot of this is going to depend, obviously, on the weight and space you have available in the design, but also on how much do you expect to be running at a lower speed, or a higher speed, or an intermediate speed. If, for example, you can run at cruising speed on two shafts using your normal propulsion system, and then you just fire up the outer two shafts and you go at full speed, you probably don't need a cruising turbine. If, however, you intend to do an awful lot of cruising, but you might want to have all your engines going, or it's just going to work out slightly more efficient, then you might want a cruising turbine. There are lots of decision points why you may or may not do this. Now, we have mentioned having three or four shaft propulsion, and of course on small stuff like destroyers you might have two, and on really small stuff like escorts you might only have one. But you do have to usually make some kind of decision on the number of shafts you want, because of course more shafts means you need more, in this case, turbines, more gear sets, and more boilers. Because if you go with, let's say, for capital ships, three shafts, then you only need three sets of turbines, however many turbines you're going to have in that set, and three sets of boilers, and each of those can therefore obviously be somewhat larger. And there are, of course, also structural considerations and tactical manoeuvring considerations to having three or four shaft propulsion, etc., etc. But it is something to think about. If, for example, your country is really good at building large steam propulsion systems, it might be better to go with fewer shafts and larger drive systems. If, however, you happen to be really, really good at making smaller units, maybe not quite as experienced at making ultra-large units, then having more shafts than average might be better. But again, various other considerations can come into play there, like, well, how much power are you sending down these propeller shafts? Because unless you want an interesting piece of modern art, you do not want to be sending several hundred thousand shaft horsepower down a single shaft on a battleship, no matter how tempting it might be. And still looking at your steam turbine system, are you going to have any bypasses in there? Now, some steam turbine systems do not have these. Others do. Now, what is this system? Well, if your turbine, let's say your high-pressure turbine, takes a hit, or it strips a blade, or anything that in otherwise renders it inoperable, that system is toast. But you might have a cruise turbine, a low-pressure turbine, and maybe even a reversing turbine in that engine set. If you have no bypasses, so the steam is purely coming into your high-pressure system and then being distributed to everywhere else, or maybe it's coming through the cruise turbine and then being distributed everywhere else, and maybe the cruise turbine has taken a hit, well, that entire engine system is down and out of action. You are getting nothing out of it. This isn't ideal, but you have saved some weight. And so on other systems, you will have a bypass or multiple bypasses where if, again, you've lost your cruise or high-speed turbine, you can go, okay, well, we're closing the steam input into that section and we're just going to reroute it through this bypass pipe, and we're going to then push the steam into, let's say, the low-pressure turbine system. Now, is that as much power as you had before? No, but it's considerably more power than you would have if you shut down that shaft entirely. And you could even take the bypass system a level beyond and have steam bypasses that would perhaps allow you to divert steam from one boiler to another, because usually you'll pair sets of boilers with a particular propeller shaft and its associated turbines. But if you want to go for the additional weight and the additional space, you could have some kind of labyrinthine steam exchange that would allow you to move steam across various propulsion units. And this could be useful because, for example, if you take a bunch of hits, you could have lost, let's say, your port outer engine, but your port outer boilers are still intact. But a hit elsewhere might have knocked out your starboard inner boilers. So at that point, you are down by two shafts, because in one, the engine's gone, and in the other, the boilers are gone. But if you have these complicated bypasses, then either you could go, okay, I'm going to feed the steam from my portside boilers to my portside outboard boilers, that is, to my inboard starboard engines. Or if you don't want to have, in the case of a four-shaft design, three bypass lines from every single boiler set to every single other engine set, and you just do them to the adjacent one, then you could go, okay, well, I will feed steam from my portside inboard boilers to my starboard inboard engine set, and then my port outboard boilers will feed to my port inboard engine set. And that way you have three shafts going, even though you've taken hits to two separate elements of your propulsion system, which is an advantage, certainly. But of course, as I said, involves considerably more weight, space, expense, and potentially piercings in bulkheads. So it is a trade-off. And speaking of boilers and their engine sets, how are you going to lay them out? Now, it might be very tempting, and indeed it is theoretically the most efficient, to go, okay, all the turbines are going in here, and all the boilers are going over here. Nice, compact, easy to do. Except for one small problem, which is, of course, if you get hit in the boilers or you get hit in the engines, you've kind of lost propulsion, potentially completely, which is not a good thing. Now, you can do the unit system. And technically speaking, the unit system divides up either a boiler or a section of boilers and the turbines of a particular power set for a single shaft, obviously, and then goes, okay, we're going to put these all in individual compartments. And then you replicate that over however many shafts you have. And then you can also start moving things around. So you might have a turbine right aft on the port side, but then the inboard turbine might be considerably further forward, and the boilers can move around as well. Now, this has the advantage of the breach of any single one compartment doesn't knock off your entire propulsion system. And by moving the boilers and turbines around, so they're not all in one block over there and one block over there, even if each section is divided up by bulkheads, it also means that a particularly powerful blow still can't knock out all your boilers and all your turbines. It might knock out some, but there'll be others elsewhere, and particularly if you have bypasses, you can fairly easily keep going. The problem here is that the unit system creates inefficiencies in terms of space layout and much more steam piping needed. So again, you are sacrificing weight and space for redundancy in this case. There is also another way of doing the unit system, which technically isn't quite the unit system, but it follows the same design principle, which is to group up the boiler and turbines for a particular shaft and put them all in one box. And then you do that for however many shafts you got. And you would have, in the case of a four-shaft design, four big boxes where you will have your four main systems. And that's used in some ships because it is slightly less weight and space efficient than just having all the boilers and all the turbines in their own two separate compartments. But it is considerably more survivable than that, while not having quite the same weight in position as a full unit system, but in exchange being slightly less survivable, because of course, if you do take a hit to one of those, if you like, power boxes, then that is pretty much that shaft dead. Whereas if you've divided the turbines and the boilers in their own separate sections, you can, at least with bypasses, do a bit of crossfeed as we described earlier. And then we're on to our final two selections, at least for this video. Firstly, what pressure of boiler are you going to use? And what manner of boiler? Because certainly by the 1930s and 1940s, you have a choice between what were rated for the time, low pressure and high pressure boilers. Now, there's no fixed setting for what is low pressure and high pressure. I mean, if you go back to the 1870s, low pressure would be measured in perhaps low double digits of PSI, and high pressure would be measured in high double digits, or maybe very low triple digits of PSI. Whereas, typically speaking, by World War II, most people are thinking roughly of low pressure meaning somewhere around 300 to 350 PSI, and high pressure somewhere in the region of 600 or more PSI. So what do these things do? Well, higher pressure boilers technically will give you more power. So you might think, well, that's a very obvious decision then. But not quite perhaps so much, because high pressure boilers require more maintenance because there's more power going through them, therefore there is more wear and tear, and you therefore will need to maintain them more often, and the need for maintenance is perhaps even more critical because a 600 psi boiler leak is not a good thing. I mean, a 300 psi boiler pressure leak is not a good thing either, but it's a considerably worse thing when it's 600 psi. And what this means is that a high pressure boiler might weigh a little bit more. It might be slightly less reliable, and you're going to need a somewhat larger crew to man it because, well, maintenance techs, but also it's going to potentially be devouring a bit more fuel. A lower pressure system, while it might be slightly less efficient at turning oil into power, is less likely to break, needs a smaller engine crew, and the consequences of failure are slightly less catastrophic. And so now you're not just thinking about the weight and space requirements for the boiler itself, you're also thinking about the weight and space requirements for the manning of the engineering section as a whole. Plus, higher and higher pressure boilers tend to be on the cutting edge of technology, so can your nation actually manufacture those high pressure boilers, and can they manufacture them in such a way that even with the aforementioned need for higher maintenance requirements, they are at least somewhere on the curve? Or is it a case of you can theoretically manufacture high pressure boilers, but they will be breaking down all the time unless you put a billion and one safety systems on them, which all have to be regulated and therefore increase your crew count. And if any one of several dozen things goes wrong, like, you know, something being damaged or someone being injured or killed in battle, the whole system can pack up and break down very, very quickly. At that point, the fact that you technically can doesn't necessarily mean that you should. But if you can manage those additional hazards and requirements, then you can enjoy all the benefits of a high-pressure boiler. So it's up to you to make that choice. The other thing to think about with boilers, at least if you are French in the late 30s and 40s, is are you going to go with forced circulation or natural circulation? Natural circulation boilers are the default. Pretty much everybody uses them. And this essentially works on heat water, hot water rise, cold water moved to take its place, cold water gets hot, cold water is now hot water rises, and then further up the system, hot water turns into steam, and hey, we have steam, fantastic. The only problem with this is that it means that the pipework in your boilers is governed by hard physical laws about how water and steam circulate. You can't make the turns too tight, you can't make everything too compact, otherwise you're going to end up with, at best, uneven pressure distribution and water hammer effects, and at worst, the whole thing going kaboom. Whereas with forced circulation boilers, you can massively reduce the weight and space requirements of your boilers by having essentially impellers, fans, propellers, whatever you want to call it, in there with your boiler water, and they can force the hot water and therefore subsequently steam to move around particularly tight corners and bends and all sorts of other things. Which means that as long as they're running, your boilers on a per square or cubic foot basis will produce much, much more power than regular boilers. And thus you can either make your machinery plant considerably smaller or keep it the same size and go considerably faster. The only downside of this is, of course, if that forced circulation machinery breaks down, that boiler is going to break down very quickly as well. So it adds an additional level of complexity and, of course, cost to your machinery manufacturing process, but it is certainly, again, something worth considering. And then finally, the steam. And you might think, hang on a minute, we've already talked about what we're going to do with the steam. We're going to put it through high-pressure turbines, then low-pressure turbines, possibly reversing or cruise turbines, and then it's going to get condensed and fed back into the system to be turned back into boiler feed water, which is then going to be heated up, and onward the circle of life goes. And yes, that is primarily what you're going to be doing with it. However, ships don't just, at least in the 20th century, run purely on the engines going whir. There are all sorts of other things that need power. Bilge pumps, lighting, electro-hydraulic motors, and a bewildering array of other things. Where are you providing this power? Well, one option is that you can have separate dedicated generators, and these can run on diesel, or you could have your own little independent steam plant if you really want to. But, hey, you have this big energetic steam plant. One of the other options to prevent you having to carry other kinds of fuel, other kinds of generators, etc., etc., might be to just tap a little bit of that steam off and run that steam through your other machinery, whether that be power generators, pumps, etc., etc. Now, of course, this does have the advantage of you don't need to carry other kinds of fuel. You don't need to be worrying about multiple furnaces or internal combustion processes going on all across the ship. And any of these additional systems are going to have access to more power than they could ever dream of. The one downside to all of this is that you are drawing from your main power source for propulsion, which means, one, if you want everything to run at the same time and you want to achieve your design speed, your boilers are going to have to be bigger than they would have to be if you were using them purely for drive purposes. And two, if anything happens to your boilers, you're also going to lose an awful lot of that ancillary machinery. And usually when something big and impressive has happened to cause your boilers to stop working, that's usually when you want that ancillary machinery, like pumps, for example. So again, a trade-off between weight, cost, efficiency, and redundancy. There is, however, one slightly underappreciated element of running everything from your power generation to your heating on steam from your main boilers. And that is, as we've discussed in many videos and dry docks before, the fact that your turbines, in this case, or vertical triple expansion engines, or whatever you're using, they have a designed rated power, which is your nominal full power. But that is not their true full power. There will be a reasonable margin above that, which you can run your engines at. It's just going to massively foreshorten their lifespan. And obviously, the further and further up you go, the more and more the chance of catastrophic failure. But there is the potential for considerably more power output in the short term. Exactly how short that short term is depends on exactly how much power you're going to shove through the thing and how much maintenance you've done. Now, why does this matter when it comes to ancillary systems? Well, obviously, you need more steam power to up the speed of your turbines. And where do you get the steam power? From the boilers. So if you do run all your ancillary stuff off of steam, and therefore your boilers are a little bit larger and they're discharging all this lovely fresh steam to all those systems, you can stop discharging that steam to those systems. And suddenly you have a whole ton more steam that you can shove into your engines to go much, much faster, which of course means you can literally order all, quote unquote, steam power to the engines, and off you go motoring off into the distance. This is exactly what the liner Carpathia did when they went to rescue the survivors of the Titanic, because she ran her heating, power, etc., etc., all off of various systems that were connected to the main steam plant. And when they realized they needed to get to Titanic as soon as possible, they bundled everybody into a few areas which they decided they were going to keep warm and lit, shut off power to everywhere else, and diverted all that power off to the engines and tore off to rescue the survivors of the Titanic. So a good chunk of those people who lived through the Titanic disaster literally owe their lives to somebody standing up there and going, "All power to the engines." Which is always a nice scene that I think doesn't really get shown in Titanic documentaries and films. And on that note, I think we've covered a good chunk of the basic design considerations that you might need to think about when you are designing a naval steam propulsion system. Once again, as with any of these sort of high-level reviews, If you want me to dive down deeper into any particular element of something that we've just discussed in a bit more detail, please let me know in the comments below. I have obviously done some videos already on Steam engines and Steam drives, etc. So you can also review those. But thank you very much for listening, and I hope to see you again in another video soon. Bye for now.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.